Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. I'm your host, Sucheta Kamath. As we keep bringing these stories about complex and wide applicability of executive function, I'm really excited to bring you the wisdom and knowledge of neuroscientists, psychologists, educational experts, particularly with the intention to transform our children's lives, our own lives, and those we care deeply about. You know, as I think about executive function, particularly in the context of learning and teaching, not just from K-12 education, but beyond, I often think about my own personal journey, and you have heard me talk about this. I grew up in India, went to Indian schools where education is very, very important, which is basically become great at memorizing and being able to write pages and pages worth narratives. I grew up during the time when there was no multiple questions, there was no fill in the blanks, there was just writing narrative questions. So it not only if you have great memory and you have good recitation and ability to vomit, as you call, you did well. And secondly, you also kind of there was no exploration in learning style, or there was no transparency about teachers' learning of students' learning. So I'll give you one quick example. One of my favorite teachers was my literature or language arts teacher throughout, in particularly in my high school. I remember him pacing in the classroom, going back and forth with eyes closed. He used to teach with eyes closed. He never wrote anything on the board. He never stopped pacing. But he was such a fantastic orator. He almost may compel you to close your eyes because he was taking you on a journey. And I kind of always wonder about his power of motivating us to read beyond whatever he was talking about, because he was so well read. And his questions were never about the story, particularly if it's like language arts. And it was all about what do you think? And no other class I remember ever asked me about my opinion. So there was no opinion question on any other part of my, it was opinion about maybe the content or how well you remember. The reason I'm sharing this with you is, do you wonder, like working with children is a big challenge, motivating children is a bigger challenge. And then we have tasked teachers and educators to be in charge of those who may be less motivated than the adults might be. And do you ever wonder how to really inspire people to become the best learners whose passion or orientation towards learning as a lifelong learner gets formed? And what is the role of teaching and learning in that? So with that in mind, I am so delighted and honored to bring Dr. Stephen Chu. He's a professor of psychology at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. He also serves as chair of the National Institute on Teaching of Psychology. Trained as a cognitive psychologist, one of his primary research areas is the cognitive bias, a basis of effective teaching and learning. His research interests include the use of examples of in teaching, the impact of cognitive load on learning, the tenacious misconceptions that students bring with them into the classroom, which helps bust. We are going to link some of his fabulous videos for young learners to learn a little bit about themselves. And the last thing I'll say about him, what is he specializes is the research speak into teacher speak. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Chu. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, pleasure is all mine. So let's start. I frequently ask this question of my guests, since you are very interested in the insights that children or students gain into their learning. Let me start by having you describe a little bit about yourself as a learner and a thinker, and with the perspective of executive function, which is self-knowledge, awareness of one's strengths and weaknesses and capacity to strategize with goal-directed effort. What was your sense of your own self as a learner? And when did you awaken to that?
Well, as you were describing your own background, I was resonating very closely to it because I was raised in a traditional Chinese household, which of course also emphasizes education. And it was my father's dream to have all three of his sons earn straight A's at the same semester. And I was always the disappointment to him. I was the youngest, and through most of my secondary education, I was not very motivated. I didn't really understand that you had to actually, study and work hard. And finally, it was my junior year in high school when I finally realized that, you know, if I put effort into this, if I focused and actually followed directions and things like that, I would actually do well. And that, I think, it made a big difference. But the advantage of that was that it wasn't other people who were forcing me to do these things. It prepared me to go to college because I was the one who had decided this is what I needed to do. You know, the responsibility was mine to, you know, create the effective plan, carry it out, and things like that. So I was not a stellar high school student, although I finished well. And then when I got to college, that's where I had the executive functions to really plan out and execute well. And that was a very important lesson to me. And it's something that I try to pass along to my students as well.
So, yeah, thank you for sharing your interesting background. You know, as we think about children our own personal learning experiences, I always tell my children, I'm grateful that I came from another country because it helped me kind of, one, appreciate the background, my own background. And then also it gave me a lens that there's some cultural translation that I need to learn off the land. And what I find from my executive function work, that a lot of times students who are in the classrooms and as they transition from single teacher run classroom to multiple teachers, it is literally code switching and understanding each teacher's ways of running the classroom and expectations, some implicit, some explicit, and also how to regulate themselves in that context. So does this analogy fit well with you as we think about where the struggle comes from? Children are not able to go in and out of different providers of knowledge.
Absolutely. And this is something when I talk to teachers, I emphasize because the students, you know, have to concentrate in each class, but every class is different. The presentation style, the expectations, the subject matter. And teachers have to remember that students are trying to juggle four or five completely different approaches to education. And it adds greatly to their cognitive load, the mental effort they have to expend. This is true in college, but it's also true in K-12 education as well. This is something we talked a little bit about my kind of awakening to executive functioning. But my son, who graduated from high school a few years ago, when he was there, he struggled because all the teachers used different methods. Some used the learning management system, some used websites, some used email. And it's asking a lot for a young adolescent to try and keep track of all of those different potential sources of information just to, you know, that's not even getting at the work itself. The work you're having to spend a lot of energy is just locating all of the assignments you were expected to do because they were in different locations. Whereas when I was going through, it was always just written on the board, you know, it was just one location, and that made things a lot simpler. So we know that one of the main constraints in the cognitive system is mental effort or concentration. And if they're having to expend a lot of mental effort just locating the assignment, that's going to leave less effort available to actually focus on the learning.
So there are multiple things that come to mind. If I can get you to start a little bit for those listeners who may not be fully, they can infer and extrapolate, but I would love to hear your definition of cognitive load. And from, you know, executive function, the key component of executive function is working memory, that capacity to bear information while applying the rules of operation. So how does, and maybe also, this is a terrible habit of mine. I ask too many questions back to back, but there's one more question I have about cognitive load, which is, do you like to distinguish between cognitive versus affective load? And maybe you can comment on that.
Okay. We can think there's multiple ways of thinking about this problem in cognition. It's everyone agrees that it's this major choke point or constraint, and it really influences ability to learn. So there's a couple of different ways you can think about it. Number one is think about it as a problem in attention. Attention allows you to select what you're going to pay attention to, what you're going to be aware of. And then it also allows you to concentrate, which is the mental effort part. And you can look at the constraint as a limited amount of mental effort that you can allocate to different tasks. So different tasks have different cognitive load, the amount of mental effort required to do them. So, just memorizing vocabulary is relatively straightforward, but doing a calculus problem or something like that would have a greater greater cognitive load because it requires more concentration to do. And if you try to do too many things and the cognitive load of the things you're doing exceeds how much concentration and mental effort you have, then your performance is going to fall apart. And that's something that teachers need to be really aware of. A lot of good teaching is attention management, always knowing where your students' attention is directed and always knowing how much mental effort they're expending. And a lot of executive function for the students is always is the same thing, not trying to do too many things at once and knowing when you're overwhelmed and kind of avoiding those situations. So you can think of it as a limitation in attention as a resource. Another way of looking at it is a capacity limitation in working memory. So we can only remember four or five items at a time. And so if we try to remember too many different things at once, then we're going to start forgetting. In a everyday sense, you can think of those two as limitations. And in cognitive psychology, it's this big controversy now about whether it's a process limitation or a capacity limitation. And we're still trying to work it out. I think everyone kind of knows they're related in some way. But from a just completely pragmatic point of view, for students and for teachers, it's just this big choke point. And you can think of it as a problem in attention, which is a process, or a problem in working memory, which is a capacity. And that's a really long, convoluted answer to your question. But anything that affects that concentration is going to hurt, is going to influence your learning. And emotions are one of those things. So that if you are in an aroused state to a certain degree, it's going to help you. You get too panicked, then it's going to hurt you, So your available mental effort actually varies according to your level of arousal. And emotion, of course, is one of those things that's really driving that.
Well, first of all, you exhibited excellent executive function to track all my questions. Sorry, you already know you have fabulous executive function, but also to hold on to all those questions in your working memory and tackle them one by one. So there's a genuine structural limitations to the way brain is designed, and then there may be some artifacts that can make it really worse. But then there's additional procedural difficulties that if we don't kind of have a solution. Can you, before we proceed into more details about students' attitudes then, can you comment on role of self-awareness? Because whether it's a process limitation or capacity limitation, there comes a point where the learning is supposed to happen and the realization that, oh my God, I'm not learning anything. And smaller the gap, better the awareness. But larger the gap, no strategic thinking or strategic steps are taken. And then the burden lies on the teacher to not only teach, but pause to check if the learning is occurring. Such a complicated process.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. If there is this huge gap between what the learner needs to do and their current like level of knowledge, they're not going to be able to know even how to bridge that gap. And part of the teacher's job is to give them the structure and the scaffolding to get to the end point, because the student often it can't see exactly how to do that. Not only that, but the research is quite clear, and this is something I've really tried to emphasize, that students often have misconceptions about how they learn that really undermine their ability to learn. So they think that learning is much faster than it is. They think that they are supposed to be naturally good. You know, this is Carol Dweck's work on fixed versus growth mindset. And so they often think that, you know, if I'm smart, this should come naturally. And if I'm not, then, you know, that's, you know, that I shouldn't have to struggle. Struggling is a sign of weakness. If you have a fixed mindset, if you have to work at something, then that's a sign of that, you know, of weakness. But if you have a growth mindset, then struggle is just part of the whole process. So students often have these misconceptions about the way they learn that, you know, that really undermine their ability to learn. They pick the worst learning strategy. The research is really clear. They prefer the easiest strategy, which is often the worst strategy for learning. So it slows them down. So it's up to the teacher to create that learning environment that will motivate the student to learn and give the student the tools to learn. You know, that's really part of the teacher's role. What I've tried to do in the work I've done is educate both the teacher and the student about those constraints and more effective learning strategies to help them both out in terms of helping the student to learn.
You know, and I think the part that really makes me wonder that if you think about learning and the invisible nature of learning, you know, only way to know if learning has occurred when you test. But the test taking has its own barriers, but test taking happens so much later than the learning happening in the moment. So unless the teacher and parents keep something embedded in the process of learning about checking, you know, I love a lot of things that I saw after the Coursera and Moodle systems came out. They would pause every 15 minutes and ask questions about learning or you know, self-efficacy questions. Are you learning what you think you're learning? What is it? And then people realize like, oh, I don't want these questions because I just want to sit through it while I'm distracting with my text. And then I just want to feel that I have some knowledge. I don't want all the knowledge and to be accurate. So this kind of creates a little bit of a painful process because, and I'll bring in my work, you know, when I work with, having done this work for 25 years, building self-awareness and self-knowledge is a double-edged sword. More you work on gaining self-knowledge, more painful and depressive it is to realize how many things are inaccurate about my self-knowledge. But without that self-knowledge, your strategic steps are not going to be tailored to your own self-knowledge. So what are your thoughts about this process, which is two steps forward and four steps backwards, but very, very critical because ultimately you can shape your destiny with self-knowledge.
No, the self-knowledge is absolutely critical. And as you say, you know, we tend to harbor kind of romanticized ideals about how much we know. And you have to be able to set those aside and be very honest about your level of understanding. So, you know, I'm a huge proponent of these formative assessments, these very brief, low stakes assessments to let the students know where they are. And so teachers should really use them, but you have to go beyond that and help the students to interpret and use the feedback.
Yes.
Because, you know, I have students who will, like, I'll give like a practice exam or a little quiz to help them to learn, and they won't do well, but that won't affect their estimate of how well they'll do, you know. And you have to say, you know, if you didn't do well on this, well, the questions are very much, you know, the same line. So you really need to use this diagnostically to think about where you need to study. Where I teach statistics, so I'll often have students, they'll work for like 40 minutes, you know, and they'll solve one problem. They'll think they're understand, and then they get to the exam and they have to do like five problems in an hour, you know. And so it's really important to help students see the value of testing themselves, of self-assessing. I mean, self-assessment is a huge advantage. And in the long run, you're going to be more successful. And in the long run, you're going to waste less time. So it's really critical to teach students those skills and to model that in the classroom about, like, see, you know, we have this feedback. How do you use this feedback? You know, and ultimately you're going to get better. So, you know, you're going to learn more and you're going to do better. And so that's really to your advantage to do these kinds of things on your own.
So you mentioned something that's been wonderful. We have had a wonderful guest, Camille Farrington, and she talks about mindset, academic mindset for productive persistence. And there are four mindsets she talks about, which is, I belong in this academic community, my ability and competence grow with my effort. You know, I can succeed at this. And then last one is that this work has value for me. And you talk a lot about kind of one, not only ensuring these mindsets are, somebody assesses them and checks in the learning community, but then you also have some ideas about how to instill some processes so that these mindsets take root. Do you mind walking us through some of the strategies that you have in mind, which is so powerful, which you were talking about, this work has value for me, is one of the things that is missed to me in my eyes, that kids have no clue why they're learning. And then they feel it's like, oh, I got a zero for things that I didn't care to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I really love Dr. Farrington's work on persistence mindset. I think that's so important and such interesting work. But it is this idea of the work having value. If the students already think they know as much about a topic as they want to, then they're not motivated to learn more. And we see this in psychology all the time. They already think they know psychology. They already think they're good at psychology. So what I try to do from the first day is to convince them that they aren't as good as they think. And if they pay attention in class, they'll actually get better at this, and it will have advantages to them. So from day one, you have to make them teachable, to say, you know, you don't know as much as you should. Knowing more will be both interesting and useful to you. Mm-hmm. That's an important part of mindset that so I think true. Often gets overlooked. Like this information is interesting and valuable. If I work in this class, I will gain this knowledge, and it will be useful to me beyond getting a good grade in this class. So that is something I think I have slowly over years realized, you know, because you come into it, we've dedicated our lives to a subject, you know, so we don't have to convince ourselves that it's very interesting. But a lot of times we just assume the students, you know, must be interested in our topic. And I tell, you know, faculty when I give workshops, remember, you know, they may not have, you know, picked your class because, you know, they were interested in the topic. They picked it because a buddy of theirs is in there, or they had a free spot at 9 o'clock and this checked off a general ed requirement or something along those lines. You know, not only do you have to present information, you have to create that mindset where, like, you know, I don't know this, but this is valuable. And if I work in this class, I'm going to gain that knowledge.
You know, funny, can I indulge you in a joke? When you talked about psychology students recently, I just texted my family yesterday this joke. It's like, my psych professor asked if we had heard of Pavlov. So I said, it rings a bell, and no one laughed. So I'm too witty for this class. Self-assessment.
That is self-assessment. I'm teaching that in my general psych class now. We just talked about that yesterday.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was so on point to what you're saying. Is sometimes we certify ourselves, particularly this whole new wave of like self-help books. People somehow feel everybody's quoting psychology research as if they understand everything about design to conclusions. And it just boggles my mind. But when you look at people trying to live in those findings, they're so far apart. So can you talk about this other aspects, which also I think there's a lot of research out there, a lot of conversations, but this idea, this growth versus fixed mindset that children bring to the table, my ability and competence goes with my effort, but they actually understand it, you know, as an abstract entity, but they don't believe in it. And so they actually don't act as if they believe in it. So there's a gap between their arbitrary or abstract notion that, I know this is really, everybody can learn to play piano. And then just says, or my favorite is, I'm not creative. Well, if you certify yourself to be not creative, then every single life's approach needs creative approach, right? It's not that creating a creative flower or like a paper mache that is sign of creativity. So what are your thoughts about reshaping those student attitudes with strategy?
No, it's absolutely essential. I mean, the students come in often thinking that they are, you know, are good at something or bad at something. And you need to convince them that if they work at it in your class, that they'll actually get better. I mean, it's about instilling that growth mindset. And it's also, you know, growth mindset really is this idea that it's changeable. You need to also add that self-efficacy where they have the tools to change it. Because even if they have a growth mindset, but they use like poor learning strategies, or they study under distraction, they're not going to do that well. And then it's just going to reinforce that, you know, that belief. It's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have to give them success experiences, and you have to kind of show them that they're capable of improving and changing. So growth mindset goes hand in hand with increasing that sense that, you know, I can do this. I have this pathway that, you know, if I follow this, I can actually improve. There's actually, I read a really good study on this the other day out of University of Georgia. It was either biology or chemistry, and I can't remember the name of the author, but she did a very in-depth qualitative study looking at students' mindset from exam one to exam two. And she found that the overwhelming majority of them wanted to change and improve, but many of them didn't know how. You know, they knew they could improve, they just didn't know how to improve. And then like a 50% like created a plan, but then that plan, they didn't actually follow up on that plan because it was sort of an idealized plan, or they had other kind of commitments and things like that. So, you know, convincing them that they can improve is a big part of the battle, but giving them the steps that's effective based on cognitive research and also executable from, you know, within the constraints the students are facing. That, you know, that's incredibly important as well, I think.
Such a good point that I think even as students devise strategies, those strategies are more abstract than concrete. And it requires another executive function skill, which is self-monitoring. which is passage of time. Am I supervising my execution or commitment to the plan that I made? Or am I flexible enough to keep modifications to the plan because it's not working? And am I monitoring my behaviors over time? So I feel another thing that is really missing in education is the temporal follow-up, you know, how my continuity of self through passage of time and continuity of goal-orientedness through passage of time. We don't teach those skills. That many adults don't think about it concretely as well. So I hope that more we know from neuroscience, we can actually embed that into everyday teaching. You know, another interesting concept that that you and your colleague, you know, William Kerbin talked about in this the cognitive barriers to learning is this student's fear and mistrust. Can you talk a little bit about that? What is that all about? So students, are you saying they don't come automatically sold on learning?
Well, there. I mean, anytime you have a transition, especially like in the first year of college, the students are wondering if they are, you know, good enough to be there. And so they have this deep-seated fear. They're devoting a lot of time and money to be there. You know, the cost of being there is mm-hmm. great. And so they are wondering if they can succeed at college. This is especially true with first generation students, for example, and often many you know, underrepresented students as well. And they are afraid that just going through this process is going to be an extensive lesson in confirming their worst fears. And oftentimes the class is maybe taught in a way it's like either you're part of the club or you're not, you know, mm-hmm. either you get it or you don't. Students come in with a vast range of prior knowledge, and the students who have that less, you know, less knowledge are going to really struggle a lot more. And that they may take that as an indication that they really, you know, don't belong in this. This has been noted in some STEM classes where it's taught to be either you're good enough to be here or you don't belong here, as opposed to like everyone can succeed. You know, I will give you the resources. You just need to kind of, you know, give me the work and I will help you to succeed. So there is fear there. And anxiety, especially if students don't do as well on the first exam as they were thinking, they, you know, wonder, is this an indication that I don't belong here? So I tell teachers in workshops, you know, when a student comes and says, do you think I can succeed in this class? What they really mean is, do you think I belong in college? And so you have to be very sort of reassuring about that. The answer to that fear and mistrust is student trust in the teacher. I'm doing a lot of work in this now. It's a remarkably under-researched area. If the student believes that the teacher is working towards their benefit, if the teacher is committed to the student succeeding, then they will work much harder. They will persevere in the face of setbacks because they believe that the teacher is really creating activities and assignments that are meant to help them learn and not hoops to jump through or activities that are meant to sort out the deserving from the undeserving. So developing that trust, having the students trust you, is really critically important, especially in introductory courses.
You know, a couple of thoughts about the trust. And, you know, again, go through the memory lane and think about my own learning experience. I took so much onus on myself. If I didn't understand something, I almost translated that I was a bad student and I was incompetent. I never, and I, now that I've become a teacher of teachers and teaching children learn how to learn, I feel one of the things that I do is self-advocacy is being able to speak on behalf of your enlightened self, which is saying, yes, this is hard for me, but that's not because I'm not trying, or that's not because it's my responsibility alone, but we share this responsibility to make my learning happen. And can you play a bigger role than I think that may be appearing sufficient right now, right? And the second thought I was thinking about was, this is traumatic part of my education, but, and I don't know if your parents ever talked since they had some exposure to learning in China, but as Indian learning environment, our teachers used to post grades, publicly display grades. And there would be a red line under which all those people who failed by name would be listed. So definitely I saw that to be such a traumatic, a fear-based approach to whole. You don't want to be there, but you also, there was such a clear hierarchy in smarts because grades always were interpreted as smarts. And then if you're not top of the heap, then you are not top. And so I'm wondering, now from there, I feel in Western education, in particular American education, kids have no clue what really competent people are doing or are capable of. So I feel we have lost somewhere that they have no clue what great work ethic looks like, what smart study strategies look like, what competent people are doing. And so I feel, do you see that gap? You know, there's both systems have overcorrected or undercorrected.
Yeah, first of all, I've been teaching long enough that I remember when we used to post grades, you know, on the door. And yes. It was, so first it was like the name and the grade. Then we did Social Security
numbers. Yes.
Yeah. And the grade, which didn't fool anybody, I don't think, because a lot of times they're alphabetical or something like that.
Yes.
That was a pretty brutal thing to have to go through to. Especially if it was like sorted from high score to low score, you know, how far low down on the list you had to go to find your name. I think you're absolutely correct. A lot of students make mistaken assumptions about how much other people are studying and the way they study and when they start studying. It's really important to educate them about like the when they should start studying, and also to let them know what the successful students are doing. So in my general psych classes, I'll ask the students who are doing really well, like, you know, when did you start studying, and you know, how have you been doing this? And then, you know, I'll circulate that anonymously, and students will realize, I want to do well, then I've actually got to start studying a week before, not just like, you know, 2 days before I'll start reading things. It's very common for students to think, you know, to prepare for an exam, I should have read everything and reviewed everything once, you know, just once completely. And so in my general psych class, a week before, I'll say, you know, if you plan to do well in this class, then you should have completed all the reading by today, you know, and you should be, you know, spend at least 3 full days reviewing things that you've already learned, because that's when most of the learning is going to take place. So, you know, they may not believe me the first time, but at least they remember I said it. And so, you know, some of them will do better the second time because they're sort of taking my advice more seriously. But, you know, that being said, we also have to remind them that it's, you know, changing behavior and habits takes time. And it's not just going to be a light bulb that's going to go off and all of a sudden they're going to go from, you know, doing poorly to doing well. It's the process of getting better, a little bit at a time, I think.
You know, I mean, they're so lucky to have you who not only is teaching them the content, but also has dedicated his life to learning how to learn, and they're deeply going to benefit. And probably contrasting that to the other professors who are not teaching it this way. I have a very dear friend who teaches astronomy at the local university. And he and I talk a lot about it, his physics rather, and then astronomy. But he says that he offers a lot of opportunities for students, office hours. I'm available. He says, I actually comment on the mistakes so that they understand. And he says, I get nothing from kids. You know, he says, I wonder if they even read my comments, you know? So I think you're right. I think that making the effort transparent, but also roping people back into the process of caring about the process. Tell me, what do you think about one of the strategies I recommend to educators is to give partial grades, or if you have a paper or project or test 100 points, always make the test for 90 points and give 10 points for process related skill set. So, you know, list three strategies that went into studying for this test. And now you give grade for that. So now you are really empowering them to think that it's not arriving at the destination, but my journey along that can also be valuable.
Yeah, I think methods like that are very powerful. In sort of the canonical way that we often give tests, it's like you do all this learning, then you do the test, and then you move on to the next topic without ever having any opportunity to actually use that feedback. So formative assessments mean, I tell teachers that the exam should never be the first time you assess students' learning. I mean, you should be assessing it all the way along. And helping the students to use that feedback. And then there's a number of ways, you mentioned a really good one, to give them the exam, but then reward actually following through. You know, the students, they take the exam. If they don't do well, they just don't want to ever revisit that exam. You know, they mm-hmm. just think that's over. I'll never have to think about that again. But that's thinking about it in terms of grades and not in terms of learning. If you think about it in terms of learning, you want them to go back into the exam and examine why did they miss this. And it's not only is it important for learning on that material, but it's important for helping them to do better on the next exam, where they won't repeat the same kinds of mistakes that hurt them on the first exam. So, reserving some points for revision, like on papers or exams, collaborative exams where they take it once on their own, and then they take it as a group, and you can average, the two scores that would work. And then another thing that I've used is what are called exam wrappers, which basically are exam debriefing activities. So you give students extra credit for going in and reflecting on how they prepared, and then looking at what they missed and trying to figure out why they missed it. Was the material not in their notes? Was it at a deeper level than they understood? Were they suffering under a misconception? And thinking about how they're going to correct that for the next exam. So that's a good way of getting students to recognize what the weaknesses in their preparation is and coming up with a plan so that they'll do better on the next exam. So it'll help their learning on this exam, but it's really geared more towards helping them to be more effective students in, starting in the next exam. So there's a number of ways of doing that, but it all has to do with making the most, using an exam, not just as an assessment of learning, but also as a way of recognizing what you're doing correctly and what you're doing incorrectly and need to change.
This reminds me of a joke, what do you call a guy who finishes last in his medical school, a doctor. So I think the fact that whether you learned or not, you are going to ultimately have so much responsibility of administering that knowledge or actually applying that knowledge. And I feel such a burden for those students, all of our students, to really kind of, that's the reason they take ownership of their learning. So as we wrap our discussion, I wish we had more time and we could talk longer, but what are a couple of books that you recommend to our listeners that have influenced your thinking or you have enjoyed understanding its content?
Well, the book I read recently, which I really enjoyed because it involves a lot of biases in terms of our reasoning and decision-making is The Confidence Game by Maria Konnikova. So she talks about how people are conned. But she does it in a way that you understand a lot of biases of of reasoning and you know, just how it can mislead you, maybe not in getting conned, but just making mistakes in everyday life. So she is a very good translator, a synthesizer and translator of research into forms I think that everyone can understand. So I appreciate her her book on that. Yeah, for my second book, I had to think about books that I kind of revisit periodically. And I've got to say, one of the series of books I've always read is the Horatio Hornblower series, which most people are not familiar with. It's British seafaring fiction, but the hero, Horatio Hornblower, is a very thoughtful, reflective person who oftentimes his planning and his reasoning overcomes kind of physical prowess. And I think that's something that appeals to me, but it very much is, I think, in the spirit of, you know, executive function, because he's very disciplined in terms of thinking things through before executing and learning from his mistakes and things like that. So actually I do think it's relevant for the kinds of work that you're advocating.
Brilliant. Well, you gave me a book to read, which is fantastic. And thank you for your thoughtful suggestions and brilliant work. And before I let you go, is there anything that you think every student, teacher, and an adult should know about the brain, the way our cognition works?
I would say that the brain is much more adaptable and flexible than most people think. And really what you're doing when you're teaching is you're not transmitting information. You're creating an environment that supports all the students in their various levels of motivation and learning that will support them in their learning. Students come in with a wide variety of prior knowledge and motivation, and what you want to do is create an environment that will be inclusive and supportive of everyone.
Well, that's a brilliant thought. So that's all the time we have today. Thank you again, Dr. Stephen Chu, for being my guest. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. These are very, very important conversations. And this knowledge is going to not only deepen our understanding of how the brain works, but how we work in the world. But more importantly, with this knowledge, the change that we are seeking and so dearly care about is made possible by this reflective and self-reflective brain. And lastly, I will say, here are a few things you can do as listeners to help us promote these amazing conversations. If you love what you're listening, share the episode with your friends, your family, your colleagues. Take a moment, if you have a moment, write us a review. And lastly, subscribe to our full prefrontal podcast, as well as the newsletter. You can always reach me at Sucheta@EXQ, Infinite Know-How. And thank you again, Dr. Chu, for being here with us and sharing your fantastic knowledge.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.